Hey everyone, if you like this podcast, go behind the paywall to get privileged access to the smartest minds in finance. Join the Real Vision community and learn how to become a better investor. Visit realvision.com/RVPod and use the promo code PODCAST10, that's PODCAST10, to get 10% off our essential membership for the first year. Now, to the top analysis of today's crypto markets.
Could a resolution in the Genesis bankruptcy come as soon as this week? We bring you the key takeaways from the first hearing. Welcome to Real Vision Crypto Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington. I'm joined today by James Murphy, aka MetaLaw Man. Welcome to the show, James.
Great to be on with you, Ash. I look forward to our discussion.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. Let's take a look at our price analysis. Bitcoin has continued to perch at around $23,000 since Saturday. That's interesting. There's interesting data from Glassnode reported by CoinDesk. The percentage of short-term holders of Bitcoin that are in profit has reached 97.5%. This is the highest number since November. Glassnode says long-term Bitcoin holders are now also in profit for the first time in 6 months. Glassnode identifies short-term as fewer than 155 days, while long-term is more than 155 days. One other optimistic piece of data comes to us from analysis at Bitfinex. On-chain data shows Bitcoin selling by miners has hit a three-year low. Meanwhile, Ether continues to enjoy smaller gains than Bitcoin. CoinDesk reports Ethereum-Bitcoin currency pair has declined 8% since January 11th. This trajectory is again playing out today, although the moves are somewhat marginal. One final token we're looking at here today is Threshold, whose ticker symbol is T. Threshold is a DeFi crypto network. T is the best performer of the day by a country mile. The token has skyrocketed 120% on a 24-hour basis. That's after crypto exchange Coinbase put it on its roadmap to listing. That doesn't mean Coinbase will definitely list it, however, important to point out. Now let's join in the conversation. Put down the questions in the chat wherever you're watching. We'll ask the best ones later on in the show. Remember, Real Vision members take priority, but the good news is membership is free. With that said, let's bring in our guest. James Murphy is the founder of financial services law firm Murphy & McGonigal. He now runs MetaLaw Man. James, welcome.
Thanks, Ash. It's great to be on with you. I look forward to getting into some of these meaty issues with you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here. First, give us a little bit of your backstory. I know we talked about this before we started the show here today off camera. Fascinating story.
Well, thank you. I've been a securities litigator for 30 years. And the last 10 years of that, I was running my own law firm and decided that I would try something a little different and created a boutique firm structure that was really exclusively focused on the financial services industry. So I hired about 20 lawyers who had previously worked at the SEC. We brought in a couple from the CFTC, and we brought together also some former federal prosecutors from the Southern District of New York. And our focus really was on Wall Street investment banks, but also trading venues like the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and the Chicago exchanges as well. And that was great, great work, exciting stuff. And then 2017 comes along and I get very interested in digital assets and Bitcoin and try to learn all I can. And I conclude that it was time for us to pivot our law firm toward representing some of these emerging companies that were, you know, the very overused word disrupting traditional finance. And in fact, they were and have been. And so it was a great pivot for us. And we soon found that given our credential base, we were representing many of the big exchanges, crypto exchanges here in the United States, as well as issuers of tokens and NFT creative people, as well as infrastructure, blockchain players, you know, security and things of that nature. And so it really raised the profile of our law firm, and we were recognized a couple of times as law firm of the year in securities regulation. And that was the first time a small firm had achieved that. And so it was a very exciting time. And finally, I'll say I really went down the rabbit hole. I know that's kind of an overused cliche now, but we even went to mining Bitcoin within the law firm. So not law firms can say that, but we had a free, meaning zero dollars per kilowatt hour, sorts of electricity at one of our offices. And so I felt there was a moral imperative to start mining crypto in that circumstance.
Well, James, you know, I and many of our viewers have also gone down that very same rabbit hole. It almost goes without saying that you're the perfect guest today to talk about some of these stories that are out in the ether. Let's jump in and take a look at the first one. Yesterday, it was the first hearing in the Genesis bankruptcy case. It took place here in New York City. CoinDesk reports lawyers for Genesis Global told the court that they've been working with creditors' representatives and the U.S. trustee's office, quote, around the clock for the past 2 months. The trustee office program is a component of the Department of Justice that oversees bankruptcy proceedings. The Genesis lawyers say that they want to reach a, quote, consensual resolution with the creditors. Notably, the lawyers said that they could reach that agreement this week. One proposed solution is a sale of the company to generate the funds. Genesis halted loan redemptions, of course, in November. The company suffered what its lawyers called a run on the bank in the wake of the FTX collapse. Obviously, some challenges coming up from 3AC and some lending that they made there as well. Last week, the lending business of Genesis filed for bankruptcy protection, as many of our viewers already know. The next hearing is set for mid-February. James, obviously there's a lot of news flow here on Genesis. This is an incredibly important story for the space. Big picture, what are your thoughts?
Well, I listened to the whole hearing. It goes on for a while, these first day hearings in a big bankruptcy case. So a couple observations. Number one, Genesis was very well prepared for initiating this bankruptcy. Unlike FTX, where it happened really kind of chaotically with very little notice and preparation, here Genesis has been working for 2 months with all of their advisors on the what-if scenario. If we have to declare bankruptcy, what should that look like? Can we do a prepackaged bankruptcy where we come in with a plan endorsed by the creditors? So what we saw yesterday was a plan, a very extensive 80-page plan of restructuring these three entities that declared bankruptcy, and a statement that it's very close to an agreement with the creditors. Now, it should be noted that's not unfounded optimism, because the creditors spoke up as well and said, yeah, we agree. We're optimistic that we can get this deal done, perhaps even this week. Now, I think what people need to understand is this deal doesn't resolve everything. The deal that was proposed by the debtor says we're going to go out and try to sell the assets of these Genesis entities, not all of them declared bankruptcy, just three, and see what kind of yield we can get on the sales of those assets. And if we, you know, whatever that is, this is how it will be distributed. This is how various classes of creditors will be treated. So it doesn't resolve everything, but rather all of the constituencies agree on this is a path forward that we hope will play out quickly.
You know, we could do an entire show just on this story here today. Obviously, there's a lot here. Let me just ask a couple of questions. So first, or just a statement, you know, most people in the space believe that Barry Silbert is a very smart guy. I think he has a background in his pre-crypto days on Wall Street working in restructuring. So probably not surprising, as you say, that he was very well prepared, or his team was very well prepared going into this. But let's talk a little bit about the prepackaged bankruptcy. I know this is an idea that many people who follow this space, particularly from the computer and engineering side, who don't have strong backgrounds on the legal side, find really confusing. This idea of a prepackaged bankruptcy, where the creditors and the debtors essentially walk into bankruptcy court hand in hand and say, we've got a deal, we've got an arrangement, this is the structure we'd like to work out. Obviously dependent on the asset base being sold at a valuation that is sort of within the range of estimates that the creditors and the debtors feel they can get. Obviously, it's a volatile space. You know, it's interesting because we've seen these nasty grams going back and forth between the Winklevoss twins over at Gemini and Genesis, getting very personal, addressing Barry Silbert directly. Of course, the entity involved in this is Genesis and not DCG, but these claims of, you know, essentially really being quite sharp, I guess it's fair to say, in the language. I know that's a lot, James, but jump in. Give us a little bit of a sense of how one of these pre-packs can unfold in the best of circumstances, and also where it can go horribly wrong.
Well, it certainly can go horribly wrong. I think what we see with Genesis is something that came very close to being a prepackaged bankruptcy. I mean, if they can come to an agreement within the end of this week, you know, we're talking about 7 or 8 days from filing to having an agreement, which would be a prepackaged bankruptcy scenario, essentially, if they had it the day they filed. So very close to doing it with that strategy. There are a couple really odd things, however, here. You mentioned Barry Silbert and DCG. There was a special committee that is isolated from DCG that is driving this, that made the decision that these three Genesis subsidiaries would file for bankruptcy. And what's interesting is the plan talks about setting up a trust to conduct litigation against some parties. And it talks about how the recoveries from that litigation will be distributed to creditors. And they describe the litigation. And the litigation starts with claims against DCG. So we're talking about really unusual here, that a subsidiary is forming a special litigation committee to analyze and perhaps prosecute claims against the parent. Now, the basis for that is DCG has borrowed heavily from Genesis. So that's spelled out in the bankruptcy filing that they had borrowed about $500 million from Genesis. And they also have a note to Genesis in the amount of $1.1 billion. It's payable 9 years from now. So,
but by the way, can we just unpack that a little bit? Because the promissory note, I think, is at the very center of this case. It effectively seems almost like an asset swap of one liability for the next. Talk a little bit about how this works, what it means, and why it's so important to this case.
Well, honestly, I don't know how the accounting treatment works, but you're absolutely right. It's a swap of a claim against Three Arrows Capital for a DCG promissory note, which presumably is a better credit than.
So let's walk through that. So essentially, the loan was made from Genesis to Three Arrows Capital. Three Arrows Capital defaulted on the loan. I believe it was $1.4 or $1.2 billion, a substantial number. So Genesis now carrying that bad asset on their balance sheet. I don't know if that's the correct legal term, but they're carrying this defaulted asset on their balance sheet. And then they swap with the parent company. They take that off the balance sheet, move it up to DCG. DCG in turn gives a promissory note. And what is the reasoning behind this? I mean, I know that this is obviously not something that you were involved with, but give us a little bit of context here for why something like this might be done.
It's speculation. I mean, the accounting really is important here. You know, there's a difference between holding a claim against a, you know, defunct entity of $1 billion or having a promissory note from a apparently financially viable entity for $1.1 billion. And so maybe a Gemini at that time wanted to appear given all lending activity that was going on each way. You know, they borrow, Genesis is a borrower, and in turn lends in hopes that the amount they pay to people they borrow from is a lower interest rate than what they can lend it to, mainly liquidity providers and crypto, at a much higher rate. And that's how they make money. But in any event, maybe there are certain requirements and covenants about what the balance sheet must look like at Gemini in order to be treated as a trustworthy counterparty for lending. So I don't know, but I can say in going through all those papers, there was an inordinate number of intercompany exchanges in large numbers. So $500 million that was lent from Genesis to DCG in various tranches. Well, there are also loans from DCG to Genesis at the same time. So I can't explain all of that. but it'll be a lot to unwind, and it may explain why there's a special committee looking at legal claims to bring against DCG.
Yeah, obviously it's very confusing. It's very complicated. There are a lot of entities involved here, entities and sub-entities, and the names sound alike. Talking of which, I wanted to get into this next story here, which is somewhat linked, I think it's fair to say, to Genesis. According to an exclusive report in The Information, crypto exchange Gemini is laying off 10% of its staff. That's the third mass layoff at the crypto company in 8 months. Gemini co-founder Cameron Winklevoss blamed, quote, persistent negative macroeconomic conditions and unprecedented fraud perpetuated by bad actors, close quote. I guess we're all left to wonder who those bad actors might be in that quote. Of course, Gemini has been caught up in the Genesis bankruptcy, as we've just been discussing. Gemini lost access to user funds in its earn program on Genesis. Cameron Winklevoss has threatened to sue Genesis's parent company, Digital Currency Group, also known as DCG, and its CEO, Barry Silbert, over the situation at Genesis. You know, obviously this is very confusing, and we're trying to unpack it here, and we're trying to explain to our audience what we're looking at. And if I goof anything up, James, give me a heads up, just shout at me, because this is a lot of information. Listen, let's talk about something here that is kind of an interesting idea that I think viewers who are maybe new to the business law front may not have a sort of solid footing in themselves. And this is this idea of these threatened lawsuits. So as a general proposition, just as a sort of a base case, a vanilla case, when you have a holding company and a portfolio company, and the portfolio company defaults on a loan or has some sort of liability and they get sued by a creditor, as a general proposition, what does the law look like around whether or not the parent company is liable for the portfolio company or operating company's liabilities? How does that work? I know this is sort of a very elaborate, sort of complex case, but as a vanilla case, how does that generally work?
Well, the reason for setting up separate corporations is to isolate the liabilities of that subsidiary from the parent. And so there are two ways generally to bring in a parent. One would be if the parent has made some kind of guarantee, whether it's an explicit written signed guarantee or some other kind of indication of guaranteeing the obligations of a subsidiary, would be one way. And then the other way is called piercing the corporate veil, which means you need to establish that there's overlap in terms of governance, that there's not a separate board acting strictly in the best interest of the subsidiary. And there are many factors under state law about how you can pierce the corporate veil and bring in the parent in that organization.
Would one potential claim, again, we're talking here is sort of in abstraction, be this idea that there had been funds that had been lent between a parent company and a portfolio company? Because I know we have already one lawsuit. I believe it's the Dutch cryptocurrency exchange Bitvavo has sued DCG, the parent company. So what are the sort of the nature of those claims? Can you make an assertion saying, hey, look, you know, there have been assets that have been borrowed and lent between these operating entities, between the operating entities and the parent companies? Is that the sort of potential claim that you might see in a court in a bankruptcy filing?
It's possible. And, you know, as long as DCG is not in bankruptcy, you can sue them outside of the bankruptcy. And so, yes, tracing funds, if it was done improperly, not at arm's length, not on market terms, then
this is a critical point, this idea of arm's length. And I know that's something that may be new to some of our viewers, but it's this idea that if an entity, a corporation, is loaning to a corporation that has some sort of shared, for example, the stakeholders, the shareholders of the corporation have some relationship, this idea of arm's length, it means it has to be done sort of as a neutral transaction that another market participant might do. In other words, not preferential treatment. That's why this phrase keeps coming up, at arm's length. And I believe, based on what I've read from DCG, that's their assertion that these were arm's length transactions.
Right. So who knows? We'll certainly find out.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick pause and hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
And then another issue is, did the paperwork, where the loans were originated between Gemini and Genesis, allow Genesis to lend those assets to affiliates, or were they restricted to only lending to non-affiliated companies like Three Arrows Capital, Alameda, you know, and many others that have you know, gone bankrupt themselves? So if it permitted loans to affiliated companies, then, you know, it's going to be hard to bring DCG in. Although, you know, the Winklevoss people say that DCG involved itself in the transactions when Gemini was getting uncomfortable about whether Genesis had sufficient assets to deliver the, you know, return the money that had been loaned,
right,
through these customers of Gemini, and that the parent stepped up, and in fact, Gemini received 30 million shares of the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. And
this, of course, from another DCG operating entity, Grayscale Investments, that controls GBTC and ETHE, among other exchange-traded products in the crypto space.
Right. So apparently the Winklevoss brothers had a right to demand additional collateral for the approximately $900 million that had been lent by Gemini's customers to Genesis. And then one interesting point that came out, Ash, is that the Winklevoss people liquidated that collateral 3 days before the bankruptcy of Genesis. And so they may have known that it was coming, and they may have had concern that they wouldn't be able to liquidate collateral after the bankruptcy was filed because of an automatic stay. Now, The unfortunate thing for everyone involved is they liquidated in, I think it was November 16th, and the bankruptcy filing was the 19th. Well, unfortunately, the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust was trading at $9 and change at that time, and now it's trading around 12. And so that differential, you know, on 30 million shares is close to a $100 million that was left on the table. You know, this is hindsight, of course. Who knew that Bitcoin was going to rock it up as it has over the last couple of weeks? But unfortunately, They realized a lot less from that collateral than they would have if they had waited.
Yeah, there are all kinds of points to make here. There's this idea of dollarization in the lawsuit, where the assets essentially get dollarized at a particular date on the filing. There's the challenge of the market prices of where these things get bought and sold. Additionally, there's the idea of clawback provisions around this, meaning, and this is a case here at DCG, Gemini, Genesis, but also a factor in the FTX Alameda lawsuits, the idea that if creditors were seen to have some sort of preferential treatment, if they attempted to liquidate a position, that a bankruptcy court might come and claw those back at some point in the future. One sort of just generic disclosure that we should make here is, obviously, you have in this case multiple parties arguing obviously different things in their pleadings, in their filings. important to point out that we have claims, we have counterclaims. Very often, those two are at loggerheads to each other. They're contradictions. We're just trying to tease out the facts here and get as much information to our viewers as we possibly can, because this is obviously a very complicated story. By the way, since I brought up FTX, James, give us your take on where we are right now in that case, particularly with regard to where some of the creditors, the users of those platforms might stand in terms of attempting to make recoveries, and what that legal process generically looks like, and also if you have any specific insights in this case.
Well, there's a lot going on in FTX. It's fascinating. I tell my friends that this case has got to show up in the law school textbooks on bankruptcy, because there's so many really fascinating issues. So just looking back to last week, Sullivan and Cromwell was appointed as debtor's counsel. There were some objections to that.
And there were objections to that because Sullivan Cromwell had worked with FTX as a client prior to representing their creditors, I believe.
Absolutely right. And they had received $8.5 million in legal fees in the 16 months prior to the implosion of FTX. And so that raises a lot of conflicts, issues. Ultimately, the judge decided to permit Sullivan and Cromwell to continue in that role. Interestingly, the U.S. trustee had opposed Sullivan and Cromwell, and then at the hearing changed its position to support Sullivan and Cromwell. At the very last minute, the chief regulatory officer of FTX dropped in a surprising affidavit accusing Sullivan and Cromwell of a host of things, including malpractice and unethical conduct. And the judge decided to just disregard that submission because this person, Daniel Friedberg, was not available for cross-examination. So in any event, that's done. The next big issue that's coming up in a couple of weeks is the appointment of an independent examiner, which would be somebody independent to come in and look at what happened and who was involved, and then make a report to the public of what happened. And the value of that is the same thing happened in Enron, that an independent examiner was brought in to study exactly what went wrong at Enron and to point the finger at auditors, accountants, bankers, and lawyers. And that report served as sort of a springboard for actual claims, ironically, by Mr. John J. Ray against the accountants, auditors, bankers, and lawyers. And he recovered very substantial amounts of money from them, due in no small part to that independent examination. So
it's like when the FAA comes in and takes a look at the black box after a right, air tragedy.
That's exactly right. And another issue, I'll just leave you with this one. I know we've got a lot to cover, but something you're going to cover in one of your next stories is, are FTX customers creditors, or are they just customers, and whatever assets are left on the platform belong to them, are left on the platform, yeah, or are traceable to their deposits, should they all go back to them? This is a huge $1 billion question. And I think the answer could, it's not legal advice, the answer could come out differently from what we saw in Celsius, where the court said Celsius took ownership of the deposits because they were authorized to lend the money out in this crypto lending situation that we see at Genesis and Voyager as well, but not FTX. FTX says it's yours. The money and assets remain your property. It never becomes the property of FTX. And if that's true, then it's not an asset of this FTX estate. It belongs to the customers. But of course, the big complication here is the books appear to have been scrambled, and it's unclear, you know, where exactly the customer deposits went and how to retrieve them. Is going to be an enormous challenge, but this is a huge legal issue that if the customer money belongs to the customer, is not assets of the debtor estate, then, for instance, none of the professionals, the lawyers, Mr. Ray, Alvarez and Marsal, the restructuring experts, the bankers are looking to sell. None of them can be paid out of those dollars that belong to the customer. So a fascinating issue. It's going to go in the law books for sure, whichever way it comes out.
This is a fascinating point, and I've been making it here in far less detail and far less technical terms. I observed earlier that much of the reporting around this interchangeably used the terms users, lenders, depositors, and creditors, when clearly that is not the case under the law. So a crucial issue that really has real-world implications in terms of who gets back what pools of assets are available to pay whom, and at what priority, which is really at the core of just about every bankruptcy case here that we've ever seen. So many incredibly important points. By the way, I should say, talking about these issues, you're tweeting about these regularly on your Twitter page at MetaLawMan, particularly around FTX, Genesis, Gemini, all important cases that you have been following very closely on your Twitter. And I personally have been enjoying that coverage. Just to move on here a little bit, because we've got some additional news flow that I'd really like to get your view on. It's great to have you here today on this day when there's so many regulatory stories. Starting first here in New York City, regulators have issued a new warning to crypto companies. Here's what the New York Department of Financial Services outlined in its open letter to the industry. The ideas that they're talking about are how customer assets should be separated from each other, something we've just been talking about here, how they should be used by custodians, another core issue, and how to maintain proper disclosure requirements when holding on to digital assets from clients. So all of that sort of very germane to the points that we've been making. The new set of guidelines applies to companies that operate in New York State and hold a BIT license. That's a license here in New York that they started issuing in 2015 to regulate companies involved in digital asset activities. James, plays perfectly into our last points. What's your take on this new legislation or regulation?
Well, two points. Interesting coincidence that Gemini was there at the inception of the BIT license. Gemini was repeatedly providing input, and I think this is a very, to their credit, a very positive thing for the industry to have a representative involved in the development of a really, really important regulatory regime. But now, this basically, the way I read that story, Ash, is that this entire business model of taking deposits and lending them to, hedge funds and high leverage players that Genesis and Voyager and Celsius were all involved in is outlawed. If you have a BIT license, forget it. You can't do that if what's required is you segregate the assets for the customer and those assets remain the property of the customer. You can't take them and lend them out to someone to try to gain, a yield on it if you are the Bitcoin licensee. So it's basically outlawed a business model which, interestingly, during this crypto winter has shown to be not a really good business model.
Especially not for the customers. James, do you hear, talking of places where this had been outlawed and we had some challenges there, do you hear echoes of MF Global in any of this?
Boy, I sure do. And right when it came out, I think even before maybe the bankruptcy, but there were whispers about of FTX, there were whispers about it, and everyone was saying, well, this is like Enron, or this is like this Ponzi scheme or whatever. I said, no, this is MF Global in all its dimensions, because in MF Global, a really popular, well-known, rich, Democratic political funder and candidate, he was the governor and senator from
this is Jersey. John Corzine, for people
John
who are
John Corzine
sure.
built up such big positions, read like Alameda, that he needed more capital to back his positions. And so they took customer deposits in these derivatives accounts that they had at MF Global. Same scenario. In that case,
the customers came out at par, I think, right? They came out whole at 100 cents on the dollar. Eventually, it just took some time to get there.
Right. So I think that Corzine didn't make a bunch of bets that were spectacularly terrible, like Alameda, that were just constantly being written off. Also, I don't believe Corzine gave himself $2.1 billion in loans, as Sam Bankman-Fried did out of Alameda, et cetera, et cetera. So they didn't have all of these components that put FTX way, way, way underwater. But in terms of how it played out in enabling, you know, outsized trades, violating margin rules, MF Global is a really good parallel.
Yeah, and it's especially interesting because MF Global was clearly regulated, clearly onshore, clearly regulated by a whole alphabet soup of regulatory agents here in the United States as well as in New York State. So that was a challenge. And by the way, I don't think anyone was ever criminally charged with MF Global, were they?
No, you make a really good point. And I did tweet out about this. There was, and we hope this is, or I hope this is not going to replay itself with Sam Bankman-Fried, but there was a multi-year serious DOJ investigation into John Corzine, and he was not prosecuted criminally. He paid a fine to the SEC, and he paid some money to settle class action lawsuits and went on his way.
Also talking about regulation, there's regulatory activity over in Europe as well. The Block reports French lawmakers will be voting in the next few hours on stricter crypto regulation. This would include mandatory licensing for providers of digital asset services. That would mean Europe was essentially, that would mean that France, I guess I should say, would have its own set of rules even before the European-wide regulations come into effect towards the end of 2024. The Block says at the moment registration is optional and no crypto company has been able to meet that criteria. Speaking of the EU, a European Parliament committee voted on new strict rules regarding capital requirements for banks that hold crypto. One amendment states that banks would have to apply a risk weighting of 1,250% of capital to crypto asset exposures. This would mean that they'd have to hold enough capital to cover a complete loss in the crypto asset value. Obviously, for those who are not familiar with it, 1,250% is a very high number for a risk-weighted asset percentage. It seems like the regulatory environment everywhere is toughening up in many parts of the world. I know these are a lot of stories over in Europe, but big picture, what are your thoughts on the general context and also on MiCA more specifically?
Well, I would say the United States is falling behind for sure. The France thing is interesting because, you know, Binance is licensed in France. So they've got a, they have a licensing regime now that is not particularly onerous, and they've rolled out something that looks more like, you know, a quite comprehensive and some would say onerous regime in the BitLicense in New York. Well, that's what they're doing, rolling out in France, and they're surprised no one's signing up for it yet. So I think they're going to have to figure out a way to encourage people to do that because right now, Binance is permitted to do business in France using this sort of regulation light approach. With respect to the EU Parliament, people are really, really interested in how that will all come out. And there will be built in, if it passes, there'll be built in 2 or 3 years of time for crypto companies to adjust to the new regime. You're absolutely right on the capital requirements under Basel III. Typically, banks have to hold 8%, around 8% for most assets. As a reserve. And here, what they're saying essentially is that banks that want to hold crypto are going to need to hold 100% of security for that asset on their balance sheet, which to me means that it is, in a sense, a sterilized deposit. So if you deposit one Bitcoin, it can't be lent. No portion of that Bitcoin can be lent to some borrower. And so what I think you're going to have happen is simply storage of these crypto assets, and maybe a fee will be charged to the depositor.
Well, that's certainly a broader theme. This notion of sterilization, segregation, ring fencing seems to be a broad theme here across the board. By the way, James, you made the perfect segue for me when you mentioned Binance. According to Bloomberg, Binance keeps collateral for some of the tokens they issued in the same wallets as customer funds. Once again, right to the same point. Binance issues 94 coins that are known as Binance PEG tokens or B tokens. Reserves for almost half of those B tokens are currently stored in a single wallet called Binance 8. This can be checked, of course, on the Binance website. Bloomberg says that the wallet contains significantly more tokens in reserve than would be required for the amount of B tokens that Binance has issued. Bloomberg says this indicates that collateral is being mixed with customer tokens rather than being segregated and stored separately. A spokesperson for Binance acknowledged the mistake. In a statement to Bloomberg, Binance said, quote, Binance 8 is an exchange cold wallet. Collateral assets have previously been moved into this wallet in error and referenced accordingly on the BTOKEN proof of collateral page. Binance is aware of this mistake and is in the process of transferring these assets to dedicated collateral wallets. Again, this idea of segregation. The spokesperson added that all users held accounts with Binance, quote, have been and continue to be backed one-to-one. So the spokesperson saying that they have one-to-one backing for all of those assets held on Binance on behalf of customers, notwithstanding what Binance called, quote, historical operational oversights. Interesting phrase there. Great data journalism over at Bloomberg figuring these things out. Again, James, all of these stories, they kind of rhyme. They all have this sort of thematic sensibility about segregating user assets, how the user assets are being controlled. Thoughts on this story and on Binance more broadly, James?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts. I guess first off, you know, the blockchain is a very useful tool. I mean, Bloomberg, with the, you know, the assistance of a blockchain intelligence company, was able to discern this, you know, because the blockchain is public. So that's a good thing, you know. So looking on the bright side, it is good that investors and journalists are looking at this stuff. Yeah. Secondly, whenever you hear the phrase commingling of customer assets with assets of the exchange, you worry because, as you say, it rhymes. It rhymes with something we heard recently of FTX. And when the official position of Binance is it's a mistake, well, that's what we heard over and over and over again from Sam Bankman-Fried. Wow, it's a mistake. I should have paid closer attention to what was going on there. Really sorry about that. So it also, you know, feeds into questions about why the auditor refuses to do future proof of reserves audits for Binance. You know, we don't know the answer to that, but it's got to make people nervous. And then you ask generally about Binance, you know, there was a really, really important story that came out of Reuters where they had spoken to many people inside the Department of Justice who said they had a money laundering case ready to go, which means ready for indictment against CZ and Binance and perhaps others in that organization. But other parts of the Department of Justice were pushing it back, not quite sure they had enough to go on, which finally leads you to this very recent announcement of this Russian exchange nobody ever heard of, something like Bizlato, I'm pronouncing it wrong, or whatever. You know, they revealed that the number one counterparty to this Russian crypto exchange, which apparently its whole purpose was to do money laundering for, you know, illegal drugs or whatever, terrorist finance, whatever it might be, that was their business model. Well, their number one counterparty was Binance. And so, you know, if you know how the prosecutors work, it's very typical to go after a low-level player to get them to flip and provide information about a bigger fish. You know, the big kahuna would be CZ at Binance. So if you put the Reuters story together with the recent, you know, hubbub around this rather small case against the Russian exchange, you know, so who knows? I don't know, but something might be coming.
James, all interesting points, and of course, just to kind of get some bigger picture takes on this. You know, one of the challenges with this space that we've seen is this idea that you have assets, asset markets, and players that are essentially highly centralized and not regulated. And it's kind of the worst of all possible worlds. You don't have true decentralization. You have these centralized parties acting in some cases, let's just say problematically from what we've seen, and you don't have the ability to truly see it transparently and openly. One of the challenges, even a proof of reserves audit doesn't really measure the proof of liabilities. There's no ability to see the broader balance sheet, the broader statement of cash flows, the broader assets and liabilities. That's the challenge here that we're all trying to sort out in this space as it moves forward. I got to move on because we have viewer questions. But before we talk about those viewer questions, for those watching on the Real Vision website, first, thank you. If you haven't signed up there yet, check it out at realvision.com/crypto. That's realvision.com/crypto. That's the best way to get early access to Real Vision crypto content, and it's always free. That's where you can find Raoul's full interview with Punk6529. It's a 2.5-hour long look inside the mind of one of the most important thinkers in this space. You don't want to miss it. Again, that's realvision.com/crypto. If you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe and hit the notification bell. We definitely appreciate it.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take another quick break and hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back to the Real Vision Crypto Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All that said, James, I want to just jump in and hit some of our questions here from our viewers because, as always, they are good ones. Vincent Rybeck on the Real Vision website asks, is there a way in the case of a Chapter 11, a non-American can make a case against a defaulted company? Interesting question, James.
Yes, non-American. By the way, there are many, many, many of these in the FTX bankruptcy because both FTX US and FTX.com, what they call FTX International, both have declared bankruptcy in Delaware. And so any creditor can file a claim or bring a lawsuit. It's called an adversary proceeding. If they have a claim that has not been reduced to some amount, like a deposit of your funds, that's a claim. You really don't have to do anything. There will be a notice that goes out to claimants all around the world saying, here's the deadline for you to file a claim. Here's the form you need to fill out. Some people get a lawyer to help them fill the form out, but it's not complicated. And then you send your form in and then, you're accepted as a creditor. And then you find out, what is this plan of resolution going to look like? How many pennies on the dollar is my class of claim going to get? Now, if you have some other kind of claim for like a breach of fiduciary duty or fraud or breach of contract or whatever, yes, you can bring those in the bankruptcy court. And in fact, you must. You can't file it anywhere else because there is a stay of worldwide litigation against the entities that have filed bankruptcy.
While they're going through bankruptcy proceedings and what potentially whether they're in receivership or whatever happens next. William Tippett on the Real Vision website, in James' monitoring of the situation, has he heard of any legal claims on Grayscale assets, GBTC, ETHE, et cetera? Obviously, this is something you touched on earlier, James. A little bit more context on your views on what's happening with Grayscale assets.
I'll tell you, this question is everywhere. Everybody wants to know what is going to happen to that Bitcoin trust that Grayscale manages. DCG owns, as far as I know, owns about 10% of that trust, of the shares in the trust. There are disputes about the Winklevoss people liquidating 30 million shares of the trust. And we don't know anything about what DCG has done with the shares that it owns. has it pledged those shares for other loans, or are they simply holding them, you know, and that's it? We don't know, but are there potential claims against DCG's ownership of Grayscale units? The answer is that is possible. And if they're dragged into bankruptcy, then that would be one of their assets that would come into the bankruptcy. If you know, that was one of the earlier questions you had, Ash, is that something that is possible of getting the parent into the bankruptcy? And if the answer to that is yes, then certainly all assets of the parent come in, including their ownership of Grayscale. Now, there's a whole different set of questions about the management and ownership of Grayscale. There's a lot, there are a lot of people who feel that the fees are way too high for kind of a fairly simple trust just holding Bitcoin. You know, you don't have analysts working day and night on a, you know, on a particular sector of stocks, selecting them. So it just
holds. And that's a whole other, and that's a whole other can of worms. And right. And by the way, they were able to charge that premium, presumably, speculative statement here, but presumably because for a very long time, it was the only way that you could get exposure to Bitcoin if you had certain covenants. For example, if you're an institutional investor and you wouldn't have the ability to directly invest in the underlying asset, you couldn't custody it yourself or whatever else was the case, you basically could go and buy this exchange traded product and then have access to that exposure. By the way, I should say for people who are not familiar with this, one of the reasons why this story is so important is the size of GBTC. Currently, I'm looking at the Grayscale website right now, assets under management, $14.5 billion. That's a lot of money. They're showing a since inception return of just under 15,000% on the website. But importantly, while that you know, number fluctuated or rose dramatically in the beginning because of the dramatic price appreciation, a testament to sort of Barry Silbert having the foresight to spin this up so early and be part of that hockey stick-like movement. The challenge right now is that GBTC is trading at a discount to NAV. That's the net asset value of about 41%, meaning you can currently buy a buck's worth of assets for 59 cents on the dollar, which gives you some context of where the market is pricing the risk in that product. Obviously, a lot to talk about there, and I wish we had more time, but I have to move on to the next question. This comes to us from Anthony H. on the Real Vision website. Boy, this is a very direct one, James. Thoughts on those who have a lot stuck in Gemini Earn and the best way to position ourselves to get it back? Boy, I feel like I should say it for you, James, not legal advice to follow.
Well, what I would do is I would get in close contact with the creditors committee to understand what they're planning on doing, what positions they're planning on taking, because unfortunately, the way it's positioned right now, it's a two-way street. It's not just Gemini's claims against Genesis. Genesis has said they have claims they intend to pursue against Gemini. So you could imagine a lot of legal fees being spilt, lost to creditors, paying for a battle of that kind. I hope that does not happen. But if you're in that EARN program, what you should do is contact the committee that represents your interest and make sure they know who you are. Make sure you know how you can get real-time information from them. And if you see them taking positions that you disagree with, and then you have a right to be heard, because in a committee setting, and by the way, unlike FTX, there are numerous committees that have been formed in Genesis because they recognize that some of the creditors have very conflicting interests in how this bankruptcy plays out. And so they have separate counsel and they have a separate, you know, list of creditors who are on the committee. Those creditors owe a fiduciary duty to all creditors who are similarly situated. So if there's a committee representing the EARN investors through Gemini into Genesis, then they owe you a fiduciary duty, and they sure as heck need to communicate with you and listen to you if you've got a point of view on how the thing ought to proceed.
James, we always appreciate very direct, down-to-earth, simple framework there. And that's a very simple explanation, I think, for people who are wondering and thinking about what they need to do next. Really fantastic conversation here today. Great analysis, incredible amount of material that we've covered here. Final thoughts, key takeaways from this conversation that you'd like to leave our viewers and listeners with.
Yeah, absolutely, Ash. Thank you so much for having me on. I have been thinking about what are the takeaways? What are the big lessons from all of these bankruptcies? And what we've seen is this business model of taking investment from investors, or in Gemini's case, you know, depositors of funds, and then having someone lend it out at high rates to very high leverage players like Three Arrows Capital, Alameda, and it goes on and on and on, is a very dangerous business model. And it works beautifully when we're in a bull market. It works okay when we're in a flat market, but when there's a crypto winter, what we've seen is every single one has collapsed. Now, somebody could say, well, they had poor risk management or poor leadership or something, and the business model is just fine. They could say that, but I think what's likely is some people are going to look at that and say, what's a better model for doing this, you know, to acting as a lender, sort of as a prime broker for hedge funds that want leverage in their trading. It's something that exists very successfully in the securities world.
Right.
Secondly, I think a winner here has got to be DeFi, because with DeFi, you get typically, there are exceptions, but you get collateral deposited into the DeFi protocol, and then you borrow another asset on that collateral. If the value of that collateral declines below a certain price, there aren't discussions. There isn't a threatened lawsuit. It is immediately liquidated by a smart contract, and just like that. And so even in the crypto winter, this is the most stress I can imagine, you know, in it, both in centralized crypto finance and in DeFi. And DeFi has held up a lot better because they just liquidate. It's a machine. It doesn't have feelings. It will liquidate the collateral before you get underwater on the loan. And then the last thing I would say is I'm just certainly amazed at how Bitcoin has held up in the face of relentless bad news. I don't, you know, I'm not a real market guy per se, but it's been amazing that you'd be tempted to conclude that there is actually some utility to holding on to Bitcoin in good times and bad.
Well, you'd certainly be tempted to conclude that the Bitcoiners have a very valid point about all the stuff that happens in the centralized world when you have the ability for human fallibility, human errors, bad actors, all those kinds of things to step in, that Bitcoin is simply not subject to. Again, not endorsement of Bitcoin, but the reality is that there is this separation of the model between what happens when you have a proof of work network that just relentlessly and consistently year after year continues to go through and secure transactions. A very different world from what we see, obviously, in the centralized space, where you have challenges with asset segregation and segregation of functionality. Right, right. You alluded to this yourself. And one of the challenges, we refer to FTX as an exchange. This is one of my usual soapboxes here on this show. But really, in the centralized finance world, it would have effectively been serving as like what? An exchange, a custody agent, an investment bank, a venture capital shop, a prop right. shop. I mean, all of these functionalities just have not been segregated. To respond to your point and my key takeaways, I think you're absolutely right. The future is decentralized. That's the direction that this is going. By the way, full disclosure, the decentralized space has challenges as well. Security breaches, we mentioned a bridge attack earlier. Right. There's significant UI and UX issues. Those protocols are not easy to use for people who don't have master's degrees from Carnegie Mellon in computer science. Right. There's a lot of challenge there. People make mistakes. They accidentally enter things incorrectly. There are challenges at that space. As well, all of these conversations that we've had today kept saying that they rhyme, this idea of segregation of assets. You know, the challenge is the reality here is whenever retail investors get impaired, that means lose money. You have regulators, legislators, law enforcement can and will get involved. They feel that they have an obligation to, and that's really what we're seeing here. And I expect that we'll probably continue to see for some time to come. James, this was just such a great conversation with you. Such a pleasure to have you on to give your analysis on such a wide variety of topics. I hope you can come back and do this again with us soon.
Absolutely. I'd love to do that.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow with the co-founders of Ethos. See you at 9 a.m. Pacific time, noon Eastern, 5 p.m. in London, live on Real Vision Crypto Daily Briefing. Have a great afternoon, everybody.